Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Take a couple of hundred economists, cram them into the same hotel, and you'll wind up with one of two things: a glimpse of what purgatory might be like, or some rare insights into where the economy is actually going. What's really happening at the annual Economists Convention? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Monday, today the 4th of January, and it is great to have you with us. No convention of the American Economic Association is complete without a speech from the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and this year's meeting is no exception. You've probably already heard about Ben Bernanke's speech in Atlanta yesterday. It wasn't low interest rates and cheap money that brought on the housing bubble and the ensuing financial crisis, Mr. Bernanke said. It was lax regulation and laissez-faire supervision. Setting aside for a moment the fact that the Federal Reserve is a key bank regulator, other themes coming out of that meeting are worth a mention. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
Some of the top economic brains in America have been delivering a not-so-happy New Year's message at their meeting in Atlanta. The financial crisis, including weak economic growth and high unemployment, is far from over, they say. And some are warning flatly the government's stopgap bailout measures are only delaying another inevitable crash. The Fed chief told the gathering that tighter regulation and careful vigilance should prevent another meltdown, but he didn't rule it out.
All efforts should be made to strengthen our regulatory system to prevent a recurrence of the crisis and to cushion the effects if another crisis occurs.
Simon Johnson is an economist at MIT. He's convinced the opportunity for tighter regulation has passed now that politicians who control the bailout strings have lost the upper hand.
These so-called too-big-to-fail financial institutions were very dependent on government support at that time, and it would have been possible to really defang those dangerous beasts that are still with us. Unfortunately, that opportunity was missed, and now the too-big-to-fail banks are even bigger, even more confident that they will be bailed out, and this is going to lead to trouble down the road.
Johnson complains they have a tacit guarantee to keep taking risks. Now, the Fed chief says if that happens, he'll be ready.
We must remain open to using monetary policy as a supplementary tool for addressing those risks.
But a glittering parade of top economists, including Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz, labeled regulatory reforms on the table totally inadequate. MIT's Simon Johnson warns government leaders are playing with fire.
My point is that there is no guarantee next time that you will have the kind of fiscal response or the ability to respond from the Federal Reserve that will be sufficient to stabilize the economy.
Which is why so many of the assembled economists remain worried about the months ahead. Johnson goes as far as suggesting lawmakers should think twice about confirming Bernanke to another term leading the Fed. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Before we move on, a thought about that meeting. Who in the heck has a business conference over New Year's weekend? Well, thanks to the Wall Street Journal today, I now know why economists do. Turns out they get better deals on hotels in the post-holiday lull. Or, put another way, they're just cheap. 2010 brings with it the census, the once every 10 years national headcount. This year, the government's spending $340 million on a media campaign to try to boost participation. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler looks at what the money is going to buy.
A 46-foot trailer and 12 cargo vans will act as moving billboards for the census, crisscrossing the country to promote participation. There will be ads on TV, radio, billboards, and even text messages. Steve Jost is associate director of the U.S. Census Bureau. He says in contrast to the last census in 2000, fewer ads will be national.
A little more than half the money will go towards local advertising in order to reach these harder-to-count communities.
People like new immigrants, ethnic minorities, and the homeless. So the census will place ads in many small newspapers, especially those targeting ethnic populations. Brian Steffens is executive director of the National Newspaper Association.
It's not unusual in small towns to have an 80 to 100% penetration in a market.
Ad revenues will help struggling community newspapers. Steve Jost says the ads could also help the government's bottom line.
For each 1% of households that mail back that form, we save $80 to $90 million in not having to go door to door follow up to those households that fail to return the form.
The ads will stress the benefits of being counted. The census determines congressional representation, plus the headcount is tied to the distribution of $400 billion in federal funding. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
President Obama is back in Washington. Members of the House and Senate are trickling back into town after their holiday break. For Democrats, reaching a final deal on health care is New Year's resolution number one. There are some differences between the two chambers, but one thing both houses of Congress do appear to agree on is that the Internal Revenue Service apparently needs more work. The health care bill that's being drafted would make the tax man the one to verify that Americans are indeed buying the health insurance they're going to have. Britt Neely has more.
If a health care bill becomes law, Americans will have to prove they have health insurance on their annual tax return. Those without insurance will have to pay a penalty to the IRS. The IRS's role doesn't come as a surprise to Robert and Williams at the Urban Institute's Tax Policy Center.
The IRS is a convenient tool because we all have to file tax returns every year. We're already sending something to the IRS telling them other things about ourselves.
William says using the IRS is based on Massachusetts' health care overhaul in 2006. Residents there have to prove they're covered when they file their taxes. But Michael Cannon at the Libertarian Cato Institute takes another lesson from Massachusetts, namely that people cheat.
There is noncompliance with the mandate. There's even evidence that people are concealing their insurance status from the government.
The IRS will do more than just collect penalties from those who don't buy insurance. It will also send out checks to small businesses and low-income Americans who qualify for health insurance subsidies. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, no New Year's hangover at all. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If the recession actually is over and the economy actually is getting better, then riddle me this. How come we had 140 banks go under last year? That's the total from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Pretty much every Friday afternoon last year, FDIC inspectors shut down at least a couple of banks, not on the face of it a promising economic sign. To get some idea of what's in store for the 8,000 banks in this country that don't fit the big Wall Street bank category, we've got William Isaac with us. He ran the FDIC back in the 70s and 80s. Mr. Isaac, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
This number of 140 banks that the FDIC took over last year, is that enough to worry about or maybe not?
I think it's somewhere between those two. It's a lot higher than we've been experiencing over the past 10 or 15 years, but it's a lot lower than we experienced in the 1980s. I would say that the number is going to remain at this level, maybe a little higher for the next year or maybe year and a half, and then it's going to start to decline.
Why are these banks still failing, though? Is it bad real estate loans, toxic assets, all those things that we read about with the big Wall Street banks?
It's all those things. We have commercial real estate losses. We have toxic assets. Mark-to-market accounting is causing failures among some of the banks. A lot of the banks bought stock, preferred stock. It's called trust preferred stock in other banks. That's been a problem for a number of banks. So those are all issues. And we're in a recession, and bank customers in a recession sometimes suffer, and that means the banks suffer.
Is this going to mean that the credit crisis might last longer than we think it will, that people will have trouble getting access to credit if these banks are still in trouble?
Right now, we're at a stage where it's very hard to get access to credit if you're looking for real estate loans, strictly commercial real estate loans. There's some funding coming to residential housing if you have good credit, but in the commercial real estate area, it's hard to find it even if you have good credit. And I think we're going to have to live with that for the better part of another year. It might start loosening up sometime next year, I hope.
Well, what can the government do? I mean, Ben Bernanke has flooded the market with liquidity. There's been the TARP. I mean, what else can we do?
Well, those are a couple of things that we need to do. The bank examiners need to be told to be reasonable in working with banks and allowing banks to be reasonable in working with their customers. The regulators have been trying to do that. They need to continue that and make sure they know that we mean it. We really do need for them to let banks work with their borrowers. That's certainly a big part of the problem.
Do you agree with Fed Chairman Bernanke in the speech he gave this weekend about the cause of the crisis really being lax regulations?
ineffective regulation, I think, is an important contributor to the crisis. I think the government bears a large responsibility for the crisis. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were out of control for about the past 20 years. Wild growth rates, decreasing their lending standards, under a great deal of pressure from the Congress to do that. The Congress wanted them to loan more and to lower their standards so more people could borrow more money, and it had to come home to roost, and it has.
What do you think about the regulations that are making their way through Congress now? Are we going to get substantive reform out of this crisis or not?
I think what I've seen so far in the House has been highly ineffective. I'm very disappointed in what came out of the House. I don't believe it is meaningful reform. I don't believe that it will do anything to prevent another crisis. In fact, may speed the next crisis. I'm hoping that we can get this thing turned around in the Senate, that the Senate will really have the courage to do meaningful reform that the House has not done.
Bill Isaac, former chairman of the FDIC, currently the chairman of the financial consulting firm LECG Global. Mr. Isaac, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Glad to be with you.
Seeing Chinese companies buy up foreign brands is really nothing new. Hummer and Saab come most recently to mind. It is less common, though, to see a Chinese company use its own brand to go after Western consumers. Today, China's top sportswear company goes straight to the heart of the opposition. It's opening a store in Nike's hometown. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
I'm standing outside Nike Town in downtown Portland. It's sort of a museum store slash shrine to the biggest athletic shoe company on the planet, and I'm talking to consumers about their shoes. And what do you wear on your feet?
Nikes or Adidas.
Li Ning. Have you ever heard of it?
No, I haven't.
Shoe shopper and avid basketball player Jason Tomlin. That unfamiliarity with China's top sportswear brand shows Li Ning has a long uphill slog ahead. But the company started slow. 2 years ago, it opened its design center here. Portland's a hub of research and development on athletic shoes. Its new showroom is in a trendy shopping district. The decor is cutting edge with Chinese cultural touches like a ping pong table and badminton rackets on the walls.
We are great value for money. The products are quality engineered. They're highly durable.
Jay Lee is head of Li Ning USA. He says the company's stressing more style and more engineering for the American market. It's also getting endorsements from high-profile athletes like Baron Davis of the LA Clippers, and its prices are slightly lower than Nike or Adidas. Still, says Lee, the company and the country have a long way to go to compete with global market leaders.
China's been known to be a manufacturing center, but China has never been known to have powerful brands like the Japanese and the Koreans do. But I believe China's time has come.
Chinese consumers surely think so. They've pushed Li Ning to $1 billion in domestic sales and helped it compete against premium international brands in China. Zhang Pei Shui is a 24-year-old college student who was shopping recently at Li Ning's flagship store in Shanghai.
Compared to foreign brands like Nike and Adidas, the price performance is good. Now, Li Ning is catching up to the international brands. The material, fabric has all improved.
Tor Peterson agrees. He's a former Nike manager who now advises Chinese sportswear companies from his office in Shanghai.
Dial back the clock 10 years, many of Li Ning's products looked very similar to last year's Nike products and Adidas products. Today, that is changing. At the fundamental level for runners and athletes, the Li Ning product can now compete.
Even so, the company faces the stigma of made in China and customer loyalty to more familiar brands, which is hard to break. But Li Ning is playing a patient, careful game, rolling out an online store later this month, but holding off on more U.S. stores until it runs this showroom experiment in Portland. And if the consumers I met outside Nike Town are any indication, it may not be so hard to crack the U.S. market. Not one said they were worried about Chinese quality. After all, the shoes they wear now are probably made there. And they all said at the right price, under $100 a pair, let's say, they'd give Li Ning's a try. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up,
ruddy oranges and reds, lots of greens and slight blue-green hints as well.
That's a roof in bloom. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials fizzed up 155 points today, 1.5% cap the first day of trading in the new year at 10,583. The NASDAQ bubbled up 39 points, 1.75%, wrapped up at 2308. The S&P 500 rose 17 points, almost 1.75%, closed at 11.32. Cold weather pushed oil prices above $81 a barrel today. That pumped up energy stocks, as you might imagine. Shares of ConocoPhillips spurted almost 3% higher. Chevron stock gained more than 2.5%. ExxonMobil shares picked up almost 1.5% today. Financial firms cashed in. Bank of America and Morgan Stanley both jumped more than 4%. Bond prices edged up. That lowered the yield on the 10-year T-note to 3.82%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. The trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org. From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for November. President Obama is back from vacation. He is scheduled to meet with advisors to discuss the circumstances surrounding the failed in-flight bombing on Christmas Day. And anyone get a car for Christmas? U.S. automakers are due to report sales for the month of December. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Everybody likes a good discount. And if you were brave enough to go to the mall the past week or so, you probably saw a lot of people enjoying the post-Christmas sales, stuffing their shopping bags full, trying to get as much for their dollars as possible. But if the stuff in question had been free, our favorite behavioral economist Dan Ariely says there may have been a different story. Dan, it's good to have you back.
It's a pleasure, always.
So in my book, cheaper prices are good, yes? Is that what you're learning here?
In general, yes, but there's some interesting exception, and the most interesting one is the price of free. Imagine that one of your coworkers come to the office with home-baked cookies, and she's offering you the cookies for a very cheap price, let's say 5 cents per cookie.
Okay.
And she has 100 cookies on the tray, and there are 20 people in the office. How many cookies will you take?
I'd probably take like five. I'd give her a quarter and take five cookies.
Okay. But what would happen if it was free?
Well, I'm torn here because I would either take a lot and be a real piggy, or I would take maybe one or two because I wouldn't want to be a glutton.
That's right. So let's assume that you will not feel like
all
being
right,
a pig.
Okay.
In fact,
right,
you can actually imagine how if she offered you the cookies for 5 cents a piece, you would feel perfectly fine to take the whole batch. But if she charged you nothing, you would not feel that you could take as much as you really want.
Is this about the value we put on it, or is it about us internally?
It's about the fact that when something is free, all of a sudden different norms get applied to the situation, and you start thinking about other people. So, you know, you have lots of other coworkers in the office, and if you took all the cookies to yourself, nobody else would have any cookie. What's interesting is that when the price is a positive price, like 5 cents, you don't actually think about the welfare of other people.
You bet, because I've paid my nickel, and by gosh, I'm going to take as many cookies as I want, right?
But, you know, this is a good deal, and you have lots of other people in the office that you like and care about. Why don't you think about their welfare? Don't you want them to be happy as well?
Yeah, I suppose. But, you know, if the cookies are good, then...
But the cookies are also good when they're free.
So
what is interesting is that when something is free, you all of a sudden think about the welfare of others. But when it costs something, it's just you and your cost-benefit analysis.
All right, so take it away from my cookies and me looking after the welfare of the office and apply it to real life then.
Well, I mean, cookies are real life. But this thought, this general idea, I think also has an applications for the carbon trade idea.
Carbon trade as in global warming? We're going from cookies to global warming?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, right? What other connections would you make?
Sure.
So think about it. Pollution, carbon trade or recycling or whatever it is in the public goods domain. We think about our kids, the next generation, kind of the welfare of the world. But if it starts costing us money, now we start to apply different norms and different rules. Now I don't think about the welfare of others. It's just about what is it worth for me to pollute and not to pollute. I'm actually worried that when we move from a system that we care about our pollution and CO2 emissions and so on, because of the welfare or generally of the world, we're going to apply a certain norm. If they charge us a lot of money, then of course we would be very careful and we might try to reduce dramatically pollution. But if they don't charge us that much, it could actually end up backfiring.
Right. So you're worried that the politicians won't be able to agree on a higher price of carbon, so it'll be something so small as to be meaningless and maybe even harmful.
That's right. If we started charging a lot of money for it, we will really dramatically change the economy, and I don't think we understand how this will work. And at a low level, I think that rather than getting us to care more, it will actually end up getting us to care less.
Only on Marketplace, Chocolate Chip Cookies to Global Warming. Dan Ariely teaches behavioral economics at Duke University. His book is called Predictably Irrational. Dan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Dan and I are going to need some help for our next conversation. We're going to be talking about wealth distribution, and we would love your input. Dan has put together a survey on that topic. There's a link on our website, marketplace.org. If you're environmentally minded, you're already plugged into the virtues of energy efficiency. It'll help control global warming and save the planet. It helps cut down on utility bills and saves you money. And in its more unusual forms, it helps farmers find new markets for their crops. From Montana Public Radio, Kevin Mackey has more.
Nate Loniker turns a valve on an irrigation system and begins watering an acre of sedums and other succulents he's growing in Montana's Bitterroot Valley. Loniker is growing 14 different kinds, and his crop is awash in color.
Ruddy oranges and reds, lots of greens and slight blue-green hints as well.
But Loniker's plants aren't meant to be decorative. They're destined for a new condominium complex in nearby Missoula, where they'll cover the roof.
This product I would put in the true green category.
So-called living roofs are becoming increasingly popular with developers looking to save energy. They provide natural insulation, reducing the need for air conditioning in the summer and heating in the winter.
We're growing it out here on traditional ag land, so it's nice to bring a little alternative ag to the Bitterroot.
Loniker contracted with a company called Zerofloor to sell his living roof. Over the past 8 years, the company has put up nearly 50 of them across the country.
We actually partner with our farms, and it's not unlike a co-op. We agree with the farmer in advance. We tell him the price that he will sell his crop to us for before he plants.
Brian Mosley heads the company's western operations. He's in Montana overseeing the harvest and installation of 4 roofs, including the one for the condos in Missoula. Loniker's succulents grow in thick colonies on carpet-like mats. He cuts them into sections with a masonry saw. He then rolls them up like rugs for transport.
The trick is to make sure this front edge is tucked nice and tight.
It's hard work. Each section weighs about 85 pounds. Loniker is one of 6 farmers across the U.S. whom Zerofloor contracts with. With demand for living roofs on the rise, Mosley says the company's looking for new farmers.
Business is growing year after year. Next year we anticipate to be so busy we're going to have to bring on more folks and expand Nate's crop, for example, and our other farmers will be expanding.
That's good news for Loniker. He's got a lot riding on this venture.
Most of the equity in my house to pay for the initial investment and all the materials, the field grading and setup, the tractor and other equipment.
Loniker and Mosley fire up a rented moving truck full of sedum rolls. Their destination, the town of Missoula, 30 miles up the road. Architect and developer Eric Hefty stands on top of the five-story condo complex Loniker's plants will cover. He sees a living roof as a natural choice for a building constructed with recycled lumber and steel.
I'd probably like to do this on every project I do if I can.
Hefty paid around $35,000 more than he would have paid for a conventional roof. He watches as a crane hoists the sedum mats onto the roof. Loniker measures one roll to figure out the best place to put it.
It's like 41 inches.
He and a couple hired hands then wrestle the mat into place.
We gotta come
back this way.
First mat down.
Hefty is struck by the transformation.
I can't believe all the color in it. You know, it's got greens and browns and rusts and grays. And it's just amazing. I love it.
By the end of the day, Loniker's mats span the roof from end to end. He stops to admire the work with Hefty.
This project will get me close to paying off my tractor and paying my loan through the winter, so it's a big deal going into the winter.
I need to borrow your tractor in a couple weeks.
To perk up the plants after their travels, Loniker takes a hose and gives the living roof a good, deep drink before winter covers it under a blanket of snow. In Missoula, Montana, I'm Kevin Mackey for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we go, an observation about the costs of a bailout. Not another one here to worry about. But by way of the world's tallest building, we learned today one way that Dubai is going to pay back the loan it got to cover that Thanksgiving Day debt default a couple of months ago. The ruler of Dubai officially opened what had been known as the Burj Dubai this morning, Burj meaning tower in Arabic. It tops out at 2,717 feet and a price tag of $1.5 billion. It also has a new name. It is now officially called Burj Khalifa after the ruler of Abu Dhabi, Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan, who, as it happens, is the guy who has given Dubai $25 billion over the past year to help it through its troubles. Coincidence, I'm sure. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow packed on 155 points, 1.5%. The NASDAQ up 39 points, 1.75%. The S&P 500 up 17 points, almost 1.75% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. You can get the latest in business and economic news tomorrow morning on the Marketplace Morning Report. And tomorrow afternoon on the big broadcast, the Postal Service posts a big decline.
We've got rural post offices out there that will spend $10 in cost for every $1 we take in revenue.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.